We talked this morning some about suffering and about how we get beyond that. C.S. Lewis knew a great deal of suffering, not just physically and emotionally, but spiritual suffering as well. I do, and that says record. It says it's full. So William may not get it. It says full, but we'll find out. I wish the books were here, as I said this morning. They were delayed coming out of the warehouse. In fact, they shipped them from Nevada to California to Texas to Mississippi as of yesterday morning. So they're somewhere on their way. But the email that I got this morning at 6:12 a.m., I got up at 6:30, but at 6:12 a.m., the email that came through said that I could anticipate their delivery to Sarah Allen's house somewhere between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on Tuesday. And, of course, what we were going to do tonight wasn't going to deal with you having to have read the first part of the book with our introduction, but I will have those. I apologize they're not here. I'm not really happy with Barnes & Noble, and I did say to someone the other day on the phone, the third phone call I made, I said, well, I don't know, but perhaps this is why I heard on the news recently that Barnes & Noble is being beat by Amazon and may have to put themselves up for sale. And she took it nicely and graciously. But those books will be here, and I will have them available starting Wednesday for anyone who ordered one, and I will make sure if we have the list, we have your names, we'll get them to you so that you can have them before next weekend. C.S. Lewis. You've probably heard the name, or maybe not. Clive Staples Lewis was his name. I kind of understand why he went by C.S. I had a football coach in high school who was C.A. Fry. That's in North Carolina. And nothing wrong with either name, but after we found out that his name was Cicero Abraham Fry, we understood why he went by C.A. He certainly didn't want to go by Cicero because you know the nicknames that can come out of that. And Abe Fry, that almost sounds like the beginning of a sentence. But C.S. Lewis was born in Northern Ireland in 1898. Lewis died in 1963. Lewis served in the trenches in World War I for the British Army. Later on in 1940, he actually volunteered during the Blitzkrieg by Nazi Germany on Britain and other places. He volunteered to be an air raid warden and often gave talks to members of the RAF, the Royal Air Force, most of whom he knew probably would not survive the first dozen missions. They would either die or go missing. In fact, Lewis, in thinking of that and knowing that, that kind of prompted a lot of what he had to say to those young men about the problem of suffering in the world, the problem of pain, the problem of evil in the world. Because of these talks and because of some reports that were given by some of the folks, the young men with whom he spoke and others who heard it, the BBC asked Lewis if he would go on the radio and present radio lectures, which he did from 1942 to 1944. These became the book, Mere Christianity. Actually, there were three distinctively different topics that he covered, but you will find in your book that those were made into four different books. If you can imagine, and it may help, because quite frankly, the further over you go in the book, the easier reading it is, but the first part of the book is somewhat philosophical. And we'll talk about that, and we'll try and make some sense, some heads or tails out of that as well. Lewis was a self-avowed atheist who eventually, and in book two, he talks about that early on when he talks about different notions of God, who eventually moved from atheism, I mean, he set about to very seriously to disprove the existence of God, only to become a theist and then eventually make his way into the Christian church. He was a member of the Anglican Communion, which Church of England, in this country, the Episcopal Church. And so he delivered these lectures that became the book Mere Christianity. If you can imagine, in the middle of war, he would go on the radio and talk to people about decent, humane human behavior in the midst of all the atrocities that were taking place. And he talked about how there was a sense of right and wrong that seemed to be inherent within people, which he called the moral law and the law of nature. Which, by the way, is one way that eventually Lewis came to become a theist and then later a Christian, because his atheism made no sense if there was some sense of right and wrong out there. I mean, if you knew something was wrong, you had to have a sense of what was right. And if you knew what was right behavior, you had to have a sense of what was wrong, whether you were taught that or not. And he comes to the position later on that there has to be somewhere something or someone out there who instilled that into the universe and into the laws of nature. But Lewis gave these, as I said, as a series of radio broadcasts, and it may or may not help. I got to talking with someone the other week about it, and they said, well, you know, when I realized it, it kind of helped to think of, as I read it, to try and hear it in my head as being read in a British voice. And as I mentioned to some of you, that's kind of where I am. You know, when I read Mere Christianity, or when I read A Grief Observed, or On the Abolition of Man, among others, I hear the voice of Anthony Hopkins. Not the Hannibal the Cannibal Anthony Hopkins, but Anthony Hopkins, Sir Anthony Hopkins, in other venues, which kind of, in a way, helps to focus in on it a bit. But he talks about decent and humane behavior in an inhumane time, a time of war, a time that we have absolutely no idea about these days, right? Just having remembered 9/11 with church members, family, and friends in places like, and having been in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and other places like that. And so perhaps in the middle of our questions about indecent and inhumane behavior by human beings toward each other, Lewis can help us that way as well. As he issues a challenge, not so much about developing a philosophy as it is a way of life. A way of life in a more humane fashion. Taking the high road. This past week, during the latter part of the month of Ramadan and approaching 9/11, we all probably saw at least once on the news that guy in Gainesville, Florida. I think maybe he had started to tailgate for the Florida game too soon. But the guy who was going to burn all these Korans, he had the right to, but the question was it right to do? In this country, he had the right to do that. But the question was it really right to do? Or was it better to take the higher road of compassion and grace and decent human behavior in the face of approaching remembrance of indecent human behavior, 9/11, rather than stoop down to the same level as those who gave that inhumane behavior? And so part of the challenge that Lewis gives is to show us that in his estimation, and he thinks in the estimation of God, there are no ordinary people. Because with God and as God's creations, we are or can be extraordinary. We can be extraordinary when we, especially when we, because of God in Christ, live decent, humane lives toward each other. And one of the ways we do that, Lewis contends, is to tell, to think about, to talk about, and to tell others about the basic common beliefs that all Christians have. not the things that we disagree about, which are generally points of ecclesiastical history or church polity or other things like that, but rather the common beliefs that we hold together. Now, Lewis was also a fellow and tutor in English literature at Oxford University until 1954, when he was unanimously elected by the faculty and by all of his colleagues to be the chair of medieval and Renaissance English at Cambridge University. Among the books that Lewis has written are the Chronicles of Narnia. And you should read all seven, not just The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And don't watch the movie first. Read the book. Read the book. I know reading is becoming less and less popular these days, but for a lot of folks. And David and Kristen both have iPads, and they use them for some stuff with internet and all, but David said it's cheaper. $24.95 book, hardback book in a bookstore, he can download on his iPad and have it there and store it and read it on an e-reader for $12.95. And that's all well and good, but there's just something about smell of paper and hold it in your hand for dinosaurs like me and for librarians. But he wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, seven books. And as I have said before, if you read them, you will find wit, you will find challenge, you will find constructive criticism, and you'll find things that cut you to the heart. And you'll say, you know, hey, that character, that's so-and-so that lives down the street and goes to that church over there. And then you'll be feeling good about yourself and get three pages over and you say, that's me. Well, let's turn over a couple more pages. Yeah. Because he did and still does challenge us. The allegory of love, the problem of pain, where Lewis talks about the whole problem of suffering and pain, and especially if we have a God that cares, what about pain in the world? A science fiction trilogy, Out of That Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. And if you read those things, guess what? You'll find a whole lot of, if you lived through or you think back to Nazi Germany, you find a whole lot of things that represent different aspects of Nazi Germany. Or we could fast forward it into the Cold War and different aspects of people in other countries, and sometimes we find aspects of our own. The Screwtape Letters, series of communications between a higher up demon and his underling who's in training and who is on the earth and supposed to be kind of creating havoc for this person, and starts writing letters back to his superior about asking questions about whether what the devil says is really right or not. And this guy's living this way and saying these things, it seems to make a whole lot more sense and make the world a whole lot better than... Rather inventive guy, but then again, he was a professor of English literature. A Grief Observed. You may or may not know about Lewis. Lewis was also a confirmed bachelor until 1956. And in April of 1956, he married Joy Davidman, who was an American poet. She had two young children. And they had a wonderful, according to Lewis and all other accounts, they had a wonderful marriage for 4 years, and she died of cancer and left him alone and devastated him. And Lewis started raising questions about this God that he had come to believe in. And now this joy of his life, not just because she was named Joy, but this joy of his life was taken away so quickly. And he wrote a book, A Grief Observed. Actually, it's a journal that was made into a book that really captures all of the feelings of loss and grief, from disbelief to absolute anger and rage to questioning God and whether God was good and really cared or not. But he also wrote the journal, he later said, to defend himself against losing belief in God. And eventually he finds his way through the grief and rediscovers faith. once again, and helps to point a way back to life and living even through grief. So when Lewis writes of mere Christianity or any other subject, he's writing of things of which he's been a part. The search for true meaning, the search for God's grace. Now, I don't know if you're aware or not, but there is in our country, in this country right now, there is a rise in what's being called the new atheism. There are books that have come out of California and other places about this new atheism and this new sense of technology, and now that we've got all these technological advances, we know all this stuff from science, we got the Hubble telescope and everything else, and we got all kinds of evil in the world, that there is no God, that we are our own saviors. Lewis felt that way back in the 30s and 40s. And yet, he comes to a position where he understands that his position of atheism, out of his own journey, was one that was untenable. One that made a whole lot less sense and a whole lot less meaning for life than did theism, much less Christianity. And so very possibly as we work through this together over the next number of weeks, very possibly we can find not only our own lives and hearts rekindled in that search, but also we can be ready to present a defense if we run into someone who is part of the new movement of atheism or agnosticism. God creates it and goes off somewhere else to play but doesn't really care. Now, Lewis says he is not going to argue denominational superiority. He'll tell you that in the preface to the book. He says, he'll tell you that in chapter 1. He said, I'm not here to say that one denomination is better than another. He said, I'm an Anglican layman. He's not clergy. He said, I'm an Anglican layman, and while there are things that I like within the Anglican Church, the things I don't agree with, and I'm not going to get into the technical differences between Methodists and Anglicans and Roman Catholics and Presbyterians and others. He said, what I am about is to talk about those things we have in common. And I would read a quote. Ever since I became a Christian, I have thought that the best, perhaps the only service I could do for my unbelieving neighbors was to explain and defend the belief that has been common to nearly all Christians at all times. I am not writing to expound something I would call my religion, but to expound mere Christianity, which is what it is and what it was long before I was born, and whether I like it or not. Lewis recognizes that there are certain things that come out of Christianity and are bases within Christianity that were around long before he ever came on the scene. They'll be around long after he's gone. And whether he agrees with them or not, they have formed the basis of Christian understanding and Christian doctrine. He goes on later to say, at the center of each, and I would say each community of faith, there is something or a someone who, against all divergencies of belief, all differences of temperament, all memories of mutual persecution, speaks with the same voice at all times. In other words, there is something common between us. And I know we're not all of the same denomination in this room. We didn't all come out of the same denomination in this room. I know that very well. We have folks who were raised as Presbyterians and Methodists and maybe even some hard-shell Baptists and very possibly some other denominational backgrounds as well. But even in the middle of that, and that's one of the things about Fifth Sunday Night, the Ministerial Association in this place, there are a lot of places where there is not an ecumenical organization that gets along like this bunch of churches does. We recognize that while there are differences, and there are some churches around here that don't want to be a part of that. I could tell you the name of a church right now where the minister has been invited three different times by people in the ministerial association for he and his church to become a part of, it's not the one across the river, to become a part of the ministerial association and the Fifth Sunday Night and that whole alliance, and to quote him, "Well, I can't ever think about being in a church and much less sitting on a platform with somebody who has different beliefs about how to understand the Bible than I do." I am so glad that we're not that way. But there are people who are. And yet, even in that, there are some common factors out of Christianity that help to tie us together. I've told in another venue before some of you that a number of years ago I used to have different folks to come and to speak to different classes and sometimes in chapel at both North Greenville and at Anderson when I was teaching in those places to speak about different aspects of religion. In the fall I would very often have a rabbi come around Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur or Hanukkah to talk about their particular historical understandings as well as their particular practices for those. After all, we are from a Judeo-Christian heritage. And in the spring, I would very often try and get either a Catholic priest, an Episcopalian priest, or oftentimes a Lutheran to come and to speak around Lent or around Easter. Never could get an Orthodox minister to come speak because, you know, Orthodox Easter and when we celebrate Easter don't always coincide. But on one occasion, not only for class but for a chapel, I had arranged for the then priest at Prince of Peace Catholic Church in Taylor's to come and to speak about Lent and the Lenten season. But about a week beforehand, he called me and he said, "Steve, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Can I ask if I can change my topic?" I said, "That depends on what it is." He said, "Well, I don't know how much you know about me or remember in our talks." He said, "But you know that I was raised Southern Baptist." I said, "Yeah, I remember that. And you also told me you're the only member of your family that's not a Southern Baptist and you're a Catholic priest." He said, "Yeah." So what do you want to talk about? He said, "Well, I would much rather, instead of talking about our Lenten practices, I would much rather this time talk about what basic Christian beliefs Baptists and Catholics hold in common." And I said, "Sure." And he did an excellent job. Because on the basics, we believe the same kind of stuff. It's the peripheral issues that we really have some difficulties with. But on basic theology and understanding what God was doing in Christ, we have much more in common than different. And I thought it was one. And he did a wonderful job. And I had a number of folks who later on thanked me for having him there. But I had a group of the Pharisees that came to my office immediately after chapel, a bunch of the ministerial students that came to my office and wanted to know how dare he say that Catholics were Christians. Well, it was a good teaching experience. An hour and 20 minutes later, I let them go. They missed their lunch. But I'm not totally surprised because there was a longtime faculty member that I knew who taught in the biology department who was talking with a member of the sociology faculty on the way out, and I was behind him, and she said, "You know, I thought that was an interesting talk." And Joe said, "Well, I think it was too. It was very interesting." And then she said, "The thing I don't understand is how he could think Catholics are Christians and going to heaven." So, we do find those kinds of things. But we find, I hope, more often in our numbers and around here, places where we can talk about the things that we do have in common, where we don't have to agree on every little issue, but we can hold hands together and stand firmly within what God is attempting to do in the world, in us and through us, looking more at those things we have in common than those differences that we have. And I think that's part of what Lewis is trying to do in this book, in a time of great horror, where war was tearing the world apart. And he wants to tell people, don't let religion be a part of that, but mere Christianity, the basis of Christianity, should pull us together, even in the midst of peril, even in the midst of horror. And when he says this last quote that I read a few moments ago, at the center of each community of faith, there is something or someone who, against all divergences of belief, all differences of temperament, all memories of mutual persecution, speaks with the same voice. That's that understanding that God isn't just the God of Baptists or the God of Methodists or the God of Presbyterians or the God of Jews. God is the God who is over the whole world and who calls us sometimes into Baptist and sometimes into Methodist and sometimes into Episcopalian or Lutheran or so on. Churches with people who are of like mind and like understanding, so that we can have more of an impact on people who don't believe or don't think it's important to learn and to know God. We'll also find in this book that there are times when Lewis, as he says, leaves the questions unanswered. Not because he doesn't have answers or preferences, but because there are some questions that he doesn't have the definitive answer for. In his book, A Grief Observed, at one point, he's talking about this loss, and he says, "If I knew that to be eternally divided from her and eternally forgotten by her would add a greater joy and splendor to her very being, of course I'd say fire ahead. Just as if on earth I could have cured her cancer by never seeing her again, I'd have arranged to never see her again. I'd have had to. Any decent person would. But that's quite different. That's not the situation I'm in. When I lay these questions before God, I get no answer. But a rather special sort of no answer. It is not the locked door. It is more like a silent, certainly not uncompassionate, gaze. As though he shook his head, not in refusal, but waving the question. Like, peace, child, you don't understand. And now that I've come to think of it, there's no practical problem before me at all, for I know the two great commandments, and I'd better get on with them. Indeed, her death has ended the practical problems. While she was alive, I could in practice have put her before God. That is, could have done what she wanted instead of what he wanted, if there had been a conflict. What's left is not a problem about anything I could do. It's about the weight of what I should do. Sometimes we will find no answers from Lewis. Sometimes we will find answers with which we disagree. Sometimes we'll find things that we scratch our heads, especially in the first part of this book. But don't despair. We'll work through those kinds of things. But sometimes it's in the silence, I think, and in the lack of an answer to the question, that we find the possibilities of where God may lead us. Lewis writes of the journey being, and I quote, "The journey is in the hall of the great house, seeking a room in which to enter and live. You must keep praying for light. And of course, even in the hall, you must begin trying to obey the rules which are common to the whole house. And above all, you must be asking which door is the true one, not which pleases you best by its paint and paneling. In plain language, the question should never be, do I like that kind of service? But, are these doctrines true? is holiness found here? Does my conscience move me toward this? Is my reluctance to knock at this door due to my pride or my mere taste or my personal dislike of the particular doorkeeper? When you have reached your own room, be kind to those who have chosen different doors and to those who are still in the hall. If they're wrong, they need your prayers all the more. And if they are your enemies, then you are under orders from God to pray for them. That is one of the rules common to the whole house. That's Lewis's way in his preface of saying it's not so much about our denominational differences, but if we're going to help change the world, if we're going to make the world a better place in which to live, then we have to not only search and find our way in the hallway. His metaphor, the hallway, the rooms, the whole house, is speaking of the whole kingdom of God and the different rooms where we find ourselves. And the hallway, that's the journey through this large house of God. And we may find ourselves in a different room from someone else, but that's not a reason to despair. It's all the more reason for us to see why we're there, to see what we truly believe and why, and to pray. The line, probably in a lot of the first part of the book, that line in the that I just read, just quoted, in his preface, probably hit me harder a while back when I picked this up to reread it after I hadn't read it in years and picked it up to reread it. Probably hit me harder than it has in a long, long time when he said, and if they're your enemies, you're under orders to pray for them. Where'd that come from? From Jesus, right? Gospel of Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And that's an order from him. That wasn't a suggestion. That was an order. Kathleen Norris, in her introduction, writes, the Christianity Lewis espouses is humane, but not easy. It asks us to recognize that the great religious struggle is not fought on a spectacular battleground, but within the ordinary human heart. When every morning we awake and feel the pressures of the day crowding in on us, and we must decide what sort of immortals we wish to be. As Lewis reminds us with his customary humor and wit, how monotonously alike are all the great tyrants and conquerors have been, how gloriously different all the saints. I gave you a handout. If you didn't get one, I've got a few more floating around here. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, is divided into four books. Book one is on right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. This is the more difficult section of the book as far as initial understanding. It's very philosophical sometimes. But in this, he's talking about the law of human nature, that it's something that seems to be inherent because we know what's right and what's wrong. And everybody seems to have some conception of what is the right thing to do and what is the wrong thing to do. And how, even before we get to a particular God, by looking at laws of human nature and right and wrong and morality, we can come to the conclusion that in all of this there has to be someone behind it. Someone who gives that and continues to give that understanding. And so the handout I gave you actually is for chapters 1 and 2. The law of human nature. So maybe as you read these first two chapters, kind of help you to see in a nutshell what Lewis is trying to say. Our expectations of fair play or morality. How does this law differ from, for example, the speed limit or the law of gravity, etc. And then in chapter 2, some objections that are raised. Some people say moral law is simply nothing more than the herd instinct. Some people say morality is just social convention. And Lewis argues against those things. that there really are not. I'll have some more handouts as we go along, but I didn't want to burden too much at the beginning. In book two, we find Lewis looking at basic Christian beliefs commonly held among Christians, and it is in this section that he will talk about, in different conceptions of God, how his view as an atheist did not work, and how in his study and in his logic and thinking through and in his encounter with God, he came from atheism to eventually believing that Christianity is indeed the way to God. In book three, he talks about Christian behavior, morality, mores, virtues, forgiveness, sin. Things a lot of people don't want to talk about these days, you know, sin and all that kind of stuff. And in book four, he deals with beyond personality, talking about the Trinity, talking about whether Christianity is really supposed to be hard or easy, talking about counting the cost. By the way, Lewis knew Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer's classic book, The Cost of Discipleship. Lewis also used to frequent, I can't remember the name of the pub right now, but he was among those called the Inklings, which included J.R.R. Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, all those kinds of things. And are we just nice people, or do we become new creatures in book four? And what does it mean then if we are indeed new creatures? He says new men, but that's old language, right? Doesn't just mean men. Do y'all have questions? This really is kind of a bunch to talk about, and rather abstractly in some instances. But do y'all have any questions before we... Yes, they did. They called him Jack. I'm not sure either. And I've never read where they got calling him Jack. But then again, you know, I understand there were people that everybody in Piedmont used to have a nickname, and all the men did, and you didn't necessarily it always put that nickname with that person, and you wondered why, you know, how and why they got it. But I do apologize again that the books didn't come in. We got them ordered in plenty of time, but they held it up at the shipping point. But they will be here, if not tomorrow, Tuesday, and I've got the list of those who bought them, and we will distribute them to you. So you have plenty of time to read the first couple of chapters, and we will move on from there. And I've tried to, as I promised a while back, keep us within the 6 to 6:45 time frame. It's now 6:45 and 50 seconds. So I got to hurry. But I look forward to this study, and I hope, I don't want to be the only one doing talking. I hope you'll have questions. I hope you'll have insights. And maybe like me, sometimes you'll be scratching your head, but we can come up with an idea together. Thank you. God bless you. Have a good week, and go in peace.